chapter 1, and we are looking at the first 12 verses. And you remember that this morning, as we talked about what we want to really look at more closely tonight, and that is orchestrating your life, we want to see the things that we talked about in regard to the provisions that God made for us. You recall that primarily 2 Peter is a book that deals with us from the standpoint of individuals. And if we're going to make progress, it is because each of us determines that that is what we choose for ourselves. And that God has made rich provisions to encourage us to make that choice of progress. And, for example, he has given unto us all things that pertain to life. And we saw this morning how that did affect the matter of physical life, but it is primarily concerned on spiritual life. And godliness, the quality of our being like God, to develop the attributes that are characteristic of God. And then we saw that we have a responsibility to realize that the promises that God made are exceedingly great and precious, and that the things that we have, we evaluate by virtue of the fact of he who articulated those promises in the first place, and it makes them infinitely precious that God, who cannot lie, is the one who extends those promises in his word. And then we saw that we are to be made partakers, that we are partakers in the divine nature of our God. And again, how that this goes along with this idea of being like God and the need for God to be early very much a part of our lives. As we continue our study now, we come to the verses that are most familiar to us here, and probably the ones that we've looked at in 2 Peter chapter 1, and that is those virtues of New Testament Christianity in our lives. And as you begin reading with me in verse 5, notice he says, "And beside this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness charity," or we might say love. I would suggest to you that in any religious experience, there are two wills involved. There is first the will of God, and we looked at that primarily this morning, that articulates those things that are necessary for us that we might be able to be what God wants us to be. But there is at the same time the will of man, and the will of man has got to be bent so that it will subordinate itself unto the will of God. This indicates then that there is going to have to be a presentation as well as an articulation of the information of God unto man, so that there might be an obedience by man to that information by which man will bend his will and bring himself into conformity that God desires out of us. So God gives us not only those things that will cause us to understand his will, he provides for us those things that will explode sin and get it out of our life. And more than that, Peter now turns his attention to the fact that God gives us those things that will enable us to grow. And this is given so that we might, by a determinate resolution in heart and mind, develop ourselves in being what God wants. And this is progress. I would suggest then, as you looked at those verses in 2 Peter 1, 5 through 7, that we have just read, that the one thing that you will note very clearly is that Peter says that we are to add to our faith. And I would suggest to you that while that little word add is there as a rather small word in the English, that it is a mouthful, as it were, in the Greek. The word in the original language is pronounced pretty much akin to the idea of epikoros again. And I would suggest to you that if you listen to that word, and I don't say it because I think I've got any ability to say those words, but I want to say that word because there's a word in the English you can kind of hear in that, and it is what this word's all about. If you listen very closely to epikoros again, what you're able to hear is that in that word is our word chorus. And that's really, literally, what this word is all about. This word is the Greek word that was used to identify the chorus director. And this guy was a little different than the kind of fellow that we're familiar with today. He wasn't a fellow who just did what Terrell did for us in leading the singing a little bit ago. This fellow was really responsible for all of the things that were necessary in the presentation of the Greek mythological plays. And these plays in Greek culture became very important, and they became very popular. And people came in droves, as it were, just to see these various plays put on. And the Epicorgon fellow was the guy who was responsible for all of the things that were necessary to the putting on of that play. Now, you know how different Greek life in theater was to ours and what we're used to. Just like in Greek theater, originally at least, there was only one actor who played all of the parts. And that you might be able to see the different roles change as characters changed in the play. The way that was done was they had a variety of different masks. And the actor was the hypocrenine, from which we get our word hypocrite. And it simply means the guy who speaks from behind the mask. He speaks the lines or the plays the part or plays the role that is assigned to him. He's not telling you the genuine things of his life. And this fella here that is associated with this little word translated in the English, ad, was the guy who was responsible, for example, to get those masks together for the play. And so if it was a comedy, all of the masks that he would gather together would be those that would have an upturned kind of a face on it. And if it was a tragedy, all of the masks would have a downturned kind of a face. And not only that, but he was also responsible for all of the stage props and all of the stage sets. You see, again, how different in our society. Today you go to the movies or you watch something on television and they roll the credits afterwards and everybody is responsible for almost an individual thing. Every little thing that has to be done, somebody's responsible for that. And the fellow who is the director, as we look at it today, is just responsible to kind of put it all together once it's there. This guy not only had to put it all together, he had to get it all together. And if it didn't come together, the only person he could blame was himself, because he didn't do his homework and figure out what he needed and have it there when it was necessary. Now, I want to suggest to you that in this sense, Peter tells us that what we've got to do is to add these virtues of New Testament Christianity to our life. And when he says that, what he's really saying to us is that you orchestrate your own life. What he is saying is that nobody else is going to do this for you. Whatever you are, whatever your strengths, whatever your weaknesses, whatever your shortcomings, whatever your failures, whatever your good points that commend you to God and to brethren and to the world are there because of you. You are the one that put them there. If there are negative qualities in your life that shouldn't be there, they're there not because somebody else forced them on you, but because you somehow or another allowed them to get in there and you allow them to dwell there. You're not making the effort that you need to make to get those things out of your life. And if, on the other hand, the good things that God requires aren't in your life, it's there because you're not making the effort to put them there. You see, you are directing your own life. You are your own personal manager. And just as the chorus director here in the stage play or at the symphony, for example, would come along and point in the various things that he's supposed to point in on the various appropriate times or cues that are necessary for him to do that, I suggest, and Peter suggests in this passage, that you do exactly and precisely that same thing with the qualities of God in your life. Whatever is there is because you've pointed it into your life. And it's there because you allow it to be there and to dwell there in your life. And so, what I want you to do is to picture for me, or with me just a minute, the kind of thing that Peter's talking about. And my artistic endeavors, Terrell, are not very great. But what I want you to do over here is I want you to picture that standing right here is the director of a symphony. And what does he do? Well, he gets out here and his symphony begins to get together. And over here, for example, maybe you've got the violins and you've got the cellos And you've got the big basses and all of those kind of instruments that are stringed instruments are over here. And then out here in front of him, he's got some of the woodwind instruments, and so he's got clarinets, and he's got oboes, and he's got bassoons, and he's got piccolos, and maybe he's got some flutes out here, and he's got those kind of instruments right there in front of him. And then back behind them, he's got, lo and behold, some French horns, and he's got some tubas that are back over here. And then over here, he's got the brass section on the other side of him, and he's got some trumpets over here, and he's got some trombones that are over here. And then kind of scattered back here to the back of this little entourage of folks, he's got a number of instruments that are rather large, maybe. Here he's got snare drums, and here he's got his big bass drums, and back here he's got his timpani section, so he's got his chimes. And he's got his bells back here, and he's got his cymbals back here, and maybe a number of other things, depending on whatever it is that they're going to be playing. And what happens? Well, he gets all of these folks together, and they get all of their instruments together, and he steps up on a stand, not much different than what I'm on then, and he picks up his baton, and what does he do? He calls them to attention. And when he does that, these folks get ready to play. And what they do is they begin to realize that they're going to play an arrangement that has been set down for them out here by somebody else. And they understand that in this arrangement that's been made for them out here, that each instrument has its own part that it's going to be playing. And they realize that maybe not all of them are going to be playing at exactly and precisely the same time. And it is the job of this epicorrigan fella down here to point in all of these various instruments whenever it is necessary for them to come in. And he's going to tell them how loud he wants them or how soft he wants them. And he's going to tell them how fast he wants them to play or how slow he wants them to play. And he's going to try to take this group and make them a united whole with each one doing his best according to his ability and his part to make this symphony work. Now let me just ask you something. How well is this fellow doing his job if all of a sudden this fellow that's sitting over here, this fellow sitting over here in the tuba section, come along and they say, you know what? The only thing we're known for is that we're great big brass instruments. And we don't get to play very much. But you know our tonal quality is just as good as these folks over here in the trombone section. And we're tired of being in the background. We're tired of not getting to play as much as they get to play. And so tonight, we're going to play their part. Now let me ask you, when you get done, are you going to have harmony? Are you going to have unity? Are you going to have them united together? Are you going to have them accomplishing according to the arrangement, whatever it is up here that they're trying to play? Not at all, are you? You're going to have some disunity. You're going to have some problems. And you're going to have some folks that are sitting out here in this audience that are going to be wise enough to realize because their ear says that's not the way this is supposed to be. That these folks are out of place. These folks are not playing the part they're supposed to play. That belonged to these folks over here. And as a result of that, this thing's a mess. This thing's not working. And they're going to walk away and they're going to say, we won't have anything to do with that. I'll just tell you what, if this is the kind of symphony that we've got here, we'll drive a little farther and go somewhere else and listen to the symphony over there, where they all play according to their own parts. Now you see, this guy is responsible to keep this thing orchestrated together. Now I want you to notice something. That in much the same way, what Peter says over here is that you are the one that orchestrates your life. And what we're going to look at is not that symphony, but we're going to look at the fact of your life. And when we do so, I'm going to get you to try to realize tonight that what all of us are doing is standing up there on the podium orchestrating our life. And that comes from the idea that what he said was that you are to add certain qualities to the life that you live. You point them in. If your life is just as empty as that little semicircle is right now of these qualities, the only person you've got to blame for that is you. There's not a bit of progress in that. There's not a bit of acceptability before God in that. What you've got to do is to realize you are responsible to start pointing in some qualities into your life that will provide progress and acceptability before God. Now, as you do that, I want you to notice something. He says, add to your faith. Do you notice that when he starts talking about these qualities, that the first thing that he says is that there is a thematic that plays all the way through your life. That thematic is always there. These other qualities are not. And those of us who preach and those of us who teach, and maybe this one won't work either, I don't know. But I have learned this. In trying to preach on these qualities in 2 Peter chapter 2, it doesn't work to do this stair step kind of thing. We've done a disservice in that. And the reason is because we get folks coming along thinking they take it one step at a time and we don't make the climb very well. He's not saying you just go down here and try to do it one step at a time. He's saying all of this stuff has got to be in your life as you grow and as you develop. This is something, he says, that is added to this constant thematic of faith that is to be in your life. And so if faith is there, it is naturally going to find expression by adding these very virtues of life. And you know, this idea of a thematic, even in music, is not an unusual idea, is it? If you're a radio listener, you probably know that the station that you listen to has a thematic. It's maybe a 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 note little tune that they play all the time that identifies their station. And every time you hear it, you know you're listening to that particular station. Or if you listen to some of these mutual radio network news broadcasts, they've got a little theme that they play musically of a half a dozen notes every time as an indication to the station that they're getting ready to come on and start relating the news that they're contracted with that station to produce over the air there. And most of the time, that little thematic gets played out over the air as their introduction. And it's something that is a logo, as it were, of the Mutual Radio Network. He says faith for the Christian is just like that. It becomes that thematic to which all of these other things are added to. Now, what does he say? He says, while you are orchestrating your life, one of the things that you've got to do is you've got to point in the quality of virtue. This word virtue is the Greek word arete. Now, some of you went to Florida College, and many of you have either gone or been associated with some of the camps that Florida College operates, and you know that they have, for social kind of activities, 4 different societies there, all designated by Greek terms. And one of them happens to be arete. And when I was at Florida College, at least, they wore red shirts and always got beat by those of us who wore the green shirts and Kappa Omicron. But nonetheless, that word arete is a word that means virtue. Now, the history of this word is that it means a ridge, like a ridge of mountains. That's an arete. And that's how the Greeks first talked about that. And you're familiar with the Blue Ridge Mountains. Well, that idea would be the word arete. And it went from that, even those of you who are from West Virginia or Eastern Kentucky or Tennessee, who are in sections that's rather mountainous, you talk about running the ridges. Down where I'm from, every once in a while you'll see somebody that's got a license plate that says, I'm a ridge runner. Well, the word arete or ridge came to mean a backbone of mountains. It was the backbone of the mountain. And that word arete came to mean backbone. And that's exactly and precisely what virtue is, isn't it? It is moral backbone. What he's saying here is that in your life as a Christian, that there's going to be a time that you're going to have some moral backbone and stand up for the things of God. And he says what you're going to have to do is to point that into your life because of faith. Faith's going to find expression in your life. And it's going to find it in your standing up and saying the explanation for who I am and why I am what I am is Jesus Christ. This is the explanation about me. And I'm going to stand there. I don't care what the world does. My moral backbone says this is right. And isn't that the quality Joseph had? When Potiphar's wife said, lie with me, he said, I won't do that. That's a sin before God. What's he talking about? He's talking about what Peter says is virtue. He pointed that into his life. He had this moral courage, this moral backbone to stand up and say, I don't care if anybody else says it's wrong. God says it's wrong, and I won't do that. This is the kind of virtue quality that translates our faith then into action. It's the courage to do right. It is a courage to walk on when you're walking in the face of a strong wind. It's the courage to paddle against the stream. It's the courage to walk uphill. Did you ever notice how much harder it is to go uphill than down? I go to the hospital, and most of the times, if I can, I run the steps. I need the exercise. But I'll just tell you what. If I'm in a hurry, I'll ride the elevator up because I've always found it's a whole lot easier coming down those steps than it is going up them. You've got to expend a whole lot more energy to go up than to come down. And this is this quality that is identified by this Greek word arete. It's a word that says you expend the energy because this is right. And you're convinced of that. It means that you hustle when you don't feel like hustling. It means you work even when you're hurt. It means that you're going to study and you're going to pray and you're going to be diligent in your Christian living. Sometimes when you're disconsolate. Sometimes when you're discouraged. And it means when sometimes you get like I get, and that is discouraged and more than discouraged, totally and thoroughly exasperated, because there are some of us who are not trying to do our best. You go on and do your best anyway. And that's this quality of virtue. It's this quality of moral backbone that says, I'm not going to let the way you act draw me down. I'm not going to let your attitudes lead me to lose my soul. If you choose to lose yours, I'll do everything I can to try to get you not to do that. But I'll tell you what you're not going to do in the process. You're not going to cause me to lose mine while you choose to lose yours. And that's what this quality of virtue is all about. And it's something that we desperately need in the church of the Lord. It's the courage to do right, regardless of the consequences. It's that which stood New Testament Christians in the face of persecution, faithful unto death. When they were given the choice to deny the Lord or be burned at the stake, deny the Lord or we're going to be had you, it was virtue that caused them to stand up and say, do what you will. We will not deny our Lord. They pointed that in to their life. And just like they did, you and I have got to. But notice he not only says that, he says, while you're orchestrating your life over here, realize that you've got to point in also this quality of knowledge. And that might be better simply said by the idea of understanding. We've got to put some understanding in our life. You know, it's important for us to have some understanding. And if you take that word and turn it around, you can begin to get some feel for it. To stand under. And really, you cannot hardly separate, can you, the matter of faith and knowledge? There's understanding it. It's kind of natural to point one of those in if you got the other there, isn't it? Romans 10 and verse 17 says, so then faith cometh by knowledge, and knowledge, or hearing, and hearing by the word of God. You've got to have this knowledge of the word of God. You've got to have some understanding of the mind of God if you're ever going to do anything in your life. If you're ever going to develop into a knowledge of what the will of the Lord is. You know, let me see if I can illustrate it. Some time ago I saw a basketball team that was rated number one in the country. And lo and behold, they went out to play one night, and you could tell they left their number one rating in the dressing room. They went out and played an unranked team, and I guess they figured that just because they showed up, the other team just passed out and that'd be the end of it. And they didn't. The other team naturally played way over their heads, and they beat them. And the most interesting thing to me was that there was some time left at the end of the game, and one of the broadcasters went over to the losing coach, and he said, "Coach," and I thought this was a very insightful question, "what happened tonight?" And you could tell the coach was totally exasperated with the whole situation and didn't want to talk to this guy at all, and was just trying to be polite, and he said, "They scored more points than we did, and we got beat. That's what happened tonight." And the broadcaster didn't look like he didn't like it. And he said, "Well, coach, what are you going to do about this?" And he stood there and looked at him in a minute, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do." He said, "Normally, after a game like this, we take the next day off. But," he said, "when I get, if I ever get, into my dressing room, I'm going to tell our players we got to practice tomorrow. And we're going to go back to basics. We're going to go back to working on passing and dribbling and rebounding and blocking out when you rebound and shooting. Because we didn't do any of that tonight. And because we didn't do it, they stole the ball. And they got a lot of easy layups. And that's what caused them to score more points than we did. And that's what caused them to win." Now, I want you to understand something. When we get back to basics in the area of religion, we need to come to understand that what we've got to do is to come back to the Word of God. That's where the basics are going to be found. And that's why when you orchestrate your life, you as one who is a Christian must point some knowledge, some understanding of God's will into your life. It's not just pointing in what must I do initially to be saved. It's not even just pointing in what must I do to worship God right or to do the work of God right. What this says is that throughout the course of my life, there is always need for understanding what God's will is as it affects me every day that I live and in every relationship I find myself. And what it says is, I can never exhaust the unsearchable riches of the mind of God as it's contained in His Word. I cannot pick up a book and finish it and say, "Well, that's it. I'll never need to study that one again. I'll never need to read that one again. I know everything there is to know about it." It doesn't make any difference how many times you study the mind of God. There's always something there if you'll dig for it and if you'll search it out. And it'll do you good. It'll make your life practical and applicable, and it'll produce progress in it. And that's what Peter says. When you're pointing some things into your life, you point in this matter of knowledge. You point in some understanding. And he says, now, here you are orchestrating your life. Point some other things in. He says, point in this quality of temperance. Or you come along and look at that, probably a little better is the revised translations, isn't it? That comes along and says, you point in some self-control. And I'm going to suggest to you that this is one of the qualities that we've got to have. This, the word self-control in the English comes really from two words. It comes from the idea of counter-roll. And you know what that is because you've seen that, you've experienced that. Did you ever take something that's been rolled up, get it unrolled, sometimes trying to get it unrolled and keep it unrolled while you're using it is a problem. But then when you got it unrolled, did you ever try to roll that thing back up again? If you did, you had a problem. Because as you rolled that up, you couldn't get the ends even. You were almost knocking those ends back in. You know, I see that a lot at weddings. You get ready to have a wedding, and what do? One of the last things these guys do that are ushering people in after they get people seated is they come down here to the front somewhere, and they get a hold of one of these white runners, and they run that thing back to the back aisle there so that the bride can walk down with that gown, that veil that trails after it, not get it all dirty. I mean, after all, she's going to wear that thing another 50 years, you know. But when we get that ceremony over, have you ever seen some frugal person come along and decide, I can use that and try to roll that thing back up? I mean, that little runner may be about that wide when it was originally produced and when they rolled it out. But when somebody starts to run that thing back up and wind it back so they can get it out of here and use it, it just starts stretching and growing and growing, and you just can't keep the ends in. That's counter roll. Did you ever see somebody that was nervous that was going to make a speech? Did you ever see them sit around and tap their papers like that, trying to get all the ends in? That's counter roll. Did you ever try to do the bulletin around here? If you've ever tried to do the bulletin around here, you know what counter roll is, because you run the stuff through that machine and it heats it up, and do you know what it does? It gives it a bowl like this. And then what you got to do is flip that thing over so you can run it through the other way. And if you do it one while it's hot, it'll just wrinkle it. So you got to do it and give it a day to dry. And two, if you don't get smart and learn what I've learned around here, and that is counter roll that thing before you put it in there the next time. Take it and roll it backwards to take that bow out of it. It'll run through there just as smooth as silk. But you know what happens when I do that? It gets all out of whack, and it takes a good bit of jostling that thing around and trying to wiggle that thing to get all of the ends back in again. That's really the kind of idea that's involved in this word self-control. Because what Christianity is all about is a constant course-correcting maneuver in your life. It's bringing your heart and your mind into harmony with the will of God. It's making sure that you're not going the wrong way. It's getting everything straightened out when you do go the wrong way. That's what self-control is all about. And I would suggest to you that self-control qualifies that control by suggesting that the control is in a person's mind. This means that your resolutions have to be under the will of God, has to be under the control of God. It means everything in the way of your aspirations are in harmony with what God has said. And this produces self-control. It means reining in your own passions. It means being the governor of your own self. It means being a practitioner of self-mastery. And when you master yourself, you produce a voluntary submission to the will of the Lord. I'm not going to just single the young people out, but it's probably the easiest way I can do it to illustrate. Young people, let me ask you something. Why are you here tonight? Now, if already it's gone through your mind that you're here tonight because your mother and dad made you come, just be honest and let it come right to the very front part of your mind. Why are you here tonight? Let me ask you something else. Would you be here if your mother and dad did not make you come? Would you be here tonight? If it really was your own choice, and there wouldn't be any yelling and hollering and screaming, and there wouldn't be any kind of resolutions, you know? If you don't come tonight, then you can just forget about going to the movies. You can just forget about using the car. You can just forget about using the telephone. You're not going to be dating that fellow or that young lady. You're grounded if you don't do that. Why are you here tonight? Would you be here if your parents didn't make you? Now, I'm going to tell you, when you answered that question, what you did, you measured your faith. You measured your own self-control. And I want you to understand something else. If you said in your mind that the only reason I'm here tonight is because my parents made me come, then I want you to know something. Your parents still control you. That's what you're saying. Now, let me broaden that out a little bit. Why are the rest of you here tonight? Are you here tonight because you don't want your husband or wife to nag you? Are you here tonight because you don't want 30 or 40 of these people to be calling you on the phone sometime between now and next Lord's Day morning saying, where were you on the Lord's Day? We missed you. And you just are getting tired of lying to us about the fact that you're out of town or you didn't feel good or whatever it is. Why are you here tonight? Are you here tonight because the preacher got up and said this morning that if you don't come back tonight, then it just shows you're not interested in progress as a Christian, and so I decided maybe I'd better come so I wouldn't look like I didn't have any interest in spiritual things. What you've done is you've measured yourself. You've measured your faith. You've measured your self-control. And what you're saying is that somebody else is still controlling you. And if you're going to be God's person, God's got to be the one that's in control. And when God's in control, you're going to point this quality into your faith gladly and willingly and voluntarily. Well, if I don't get on, I'm going to be in trouble. He says, add to your faith patience. Patience is the moral determination to stay and wait. Patience is probably one of those qualities that most of us lack about as much as anything there is in New Testament Christianity. Patience, we don't have it. I try to tell this guy something that I think guys like this guy that preach the gospel need more than anything else that I know they need. And that is, add a little patience to your life. It's easy for me to sit down with my conscience and my Bible and my God and to come to see what God has said about a passage and get up here and hammer on it as hard as I can hammer on it and then give you about 2 minutes to make up your mind I'm right and fall in line. Sometimes we don't have very much patience in dealing with one another. And preachers are about as guilty of that as anybody. But I'm not going to let the brethren off the hook either. Sometimes we get out here and we get in a situation that has existed for years and years and years, and we look at that thing and we assess it, and in a moment of time we say, that can't be, it's got to be some other way, and if it doesn't work out right then, immediately, then we just create all kinds of havoc. We don't have a lot of patience. Brethren, I want to tell you something. If you've not learned this yet, you need to learn it. You cannot take an ongoing situation that has been a year old or 2 years old or 5 years old and turn it around overnight. It won't work that fast. Somebody else is not going to come to that kind of resolute understanding as quickly as you did. If it works that way, then let me challenge you to do something. Just sit down and memorize the passages on what a person has to do to be saved and go around your neighborhood. And when they open the door, start quoting them to them. And when you get done with what God says they've got to do to be a Christian, look at them and say, now, make up your mind whether you're going to do that or not. You've got 30 seconds. And when they shut the door in your face, then you just go on to the next house and wonder why it is we can't convert anybody. Those folks that don't see the necessity of being baptized in order to be saved have had all kinds of help trying to explain away what the Bible teaches about the necessity of baptism. And you're not going to be able, just by citing two or three very plain passages of Scripture, reach that person in a moment. You're going to have to be patient in your teaching of them. If we can see that with the world, can't we see that with one another? Can't we see that sometimes some things develop and maybe have over years? And maybe they do need to be changed. But let's be patient and persistent and loving and gentle in trying to give that person some time to come around to seeing it as God sees it. We need some patience if we've ever needed anything. Well, let me suggest something else. He says also, you've got to add some godliness to your life. You've got to keep adding these qualities in. You've got to keep trying to point them in there. You've got to live all of your life with the realization that God's got to be a part of it. We've talked about this some today. And we don't do that very well either, do we? Do you know sometimes what happens? We'll look everywhere but God for the solutions to the problems of our life. We'll look at what sociologists or psychologists or historians have to say about it. We'll look at the religious theologians and see what they say. We'll listen to Phil Donahue and Oprah Winfrey and all of those people that are on there telling us about the same kind of things that we think we're experiencing in our lives, how they dealt with them. And we'll listen to somebody who's got some kind of a PhD degree after their name, who's written on this particular thing, and when we can't solve that thing, finally and ultimately, somebody causes the light to go on, and somebody will say, well, let's give God a try. By the time we do that, it's too late. I don't care if it's with your marriage, I don't care if it's with your kids, I don't care what it's with. God's got to be involved early and constantly and continuously in our lives, or it's not going to work, and that's godliness. And he says, and to godliness, some brotherly kindness. He wants us to point this quality in. This is the word phileo. You know that word because you know Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. And this is a kind of longing desire for the opportunity of doing good to all men. We need some kindness among us. We need that in Oakwood. We need that in the church everywhere I go. And if we don't get some, we're going to splinter ourselves into non-existence. There are going to be so many isolated little groups hanging around all over the country that nobody's going to know what anybody's all about. We need some brotherly kindness. And we've kind of gotten to the point to where our pride is so strong that we would not dare eat crow. We've reached the point where we will not back down on anything, where we're going to protect our pride at all cost. And it doesn't matter if it means that it's going to include a lie. It doesn't even matter if it includes living a lie. We're going to protect our pride. And I'm going to tell you something. That's foolishness gone to seed. And it's going to kill us congregationally. And it will kill you spiritually before God. And if you don't want this in your life, if you want to point this to the exit door where it belongs, what you point in its stead is some brotherly kindness. You can't go to heaven with that kind of guilt on you. I just tell you. And if you're carrying around this pride that refuses to allow me to be the person God wants me to be, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell it to you as plain as I can. It's a sack of rocks. And you need to get rid of it. Because it's just weighting you down. It's dragging you down. It's hurting you every step that you take. And it's going to drag you right down to the devil's hell. You better get rid of it. And what you need is some brotherly kindness. And then he says, while you're at it, point in love. Somebody says, I thought we just talked about that. We did. But now we talk about the grandest energy of all. Because this is the word agapo. Agape. This is the energy, the most outstanding motive of all. You see, agape love has God in what he is, arousing in me my sense of ought. Agape is a selfless, remember we talked about self this morning and how it has to be removed? That's what this pointing in of this quality does. It takes self and takes it out because it's a selfless kind of love. It becomes a deliberate desire for the good of the object without considering the worthiness of that object. It means that you can learn to love the unlovely. It means that you can learn to seek the best interest in people who don't deserve the best interest. It means that you can learn to love the unlovable person who has some kind of an idiosyncratic kind of a nature that you just literally despise. But you can learn to at least like that person. In 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 13, Paul says, now abideth faith, hope, and love. You pointing it into your life? You don't point it in some way that does not reflect itself, because it always shows. You orchestrate your life. You, and you only, for your life, pick up the baton, and you say, I want some attention here. We're going to do things God's way. We're going to enthrone Jesus as the Lord of our life, and we're going to do what he says, and this is what we're going to point in. Well, I'm way out of time, and I'm not way out of passage. I want you just briefly to see the blessings. He says, what does this accomplish? He says, it'll make you to abound. And the word abound there comes from a word that means more, and it speaks of quantity, not quality. Quality is there, but it speaks primarily of quantity. In fact, it could have been translated super abound. Isn't that what growing's all about? And what it also says is that it makes you, you'll not be barren nor unfruitful. And he says not only that, but in verse 9, that if you don't do this, you're blind. And the word that he uses for blind here is not the word that means you cannot see. It is the Greek word myoptic. And what it means, I understand real well. Because you see, that's why I wear these things. Because I physically am myoptic. I'm nearsighted. I can take these things off and I can see all of you so these kids back here can't make faces at me and think they can get by with it. And I can take them off, and I hate to say it, but I still can see that I'm overtime on that clock. And I can take them off, and if Jim Smith had opened those back doors, I could read Knowwood Church of Christ on that sign out there. But because the letters are big and the background is just right, I can read that. But I can't stand here and read the good quotation that Brother Johnson puts on there week after week. I got to either say, okay, oh, that's what that says. Or I got to get a whole lot closer to see it. Because I can't see things far off without these things. He's talking about spiritual nearsightedness. He says if you don't point these things into your life, what it says about you is you're just living for the moment. You're just living for the